Okay. Merry Nitelnacht to all of you. Sicha is dedicated to Sammy, who we know. Who says that his childhood is ending tonight. I am not making any apologies. Obviously, the topic most of you know already is the topic of Christmas, and I have no intention of quoting any Jewish sources here. Everything I'll be quoting tonight is either from the Catholic Church itself or from secular sources. Additionally, I also told Sammy that I would say, just so that people understand, it's a very common thing for especially Americans to think about Christmas in sort of a very beautiful way. The lights, the whole Avira, Santa, you know, the bell, everyone giving tzedakah. It's kind of a beautiful holiday. And it's true, I myself was into it, probably not to that degree when I was a little kid, but I definitely used to drive. I remember every Hanukkah I would drive to my Rebbe's house in Borough Park, and we would always see this house that had incredible lights. And yeah, it's taka very pretty. I even one time when I was dating my wife, we went to the Bronx Zoo in the middle of the season, and they had all this, you know, ice sculpting and all these beautiful lights, and okay, Seder, that was the, I was into it, I'm not going to lie to you, I was into it. But having said that, when I actually did do the research and discovered what Christmas was all about, so obviously it sort of left a bitter taste in my mind. Some of you are familiar with a pretty well-known Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman shiur on this subject. So this shiur is very much taken from that shiur, but there's actually a lot of research that I've done on my own that is also in this shiur. So for those of you who have heard this shiur before, I guarantee you that there will be a lot of new stuff. Okay, we cannot begin Christmas without talking about the birth of Jesus. Okay, because Christmas supposedly celebrates the birth of Jesus. So we need to, number one, find out, was Jesus actually born on December 25th? And that is the popular myth that Jesus was born on December 25th in the year 1 CE. The New Testament actually gives no date or year of Jesus' birth. The earliest gospel, St. Mark, which was written about 65 years later, 65 CE, begins with the baptism of an adult Jesus. This basically suggests that Christians were not interested or didn't really know when Jesus himself was born. So where does this concept of where he was, when he was born, come from? It came from literally a mathematical mistake from a Scythian monk whose name was Dionysius Exiguus. He was the abbot of a Roman monastery. And his calculation went as follows. Again, I'm going to do the math pretty quickly here. Try to stay with me. If you miss it, it's not a big deal. In the Roman era, the way things were counted was called AUC, Abba Urba Condita. That's Roman for the founding of the city of Rome. So, okay, so 1 AUC was the first year of Rome. That was the year that Rome was founded. 5 AUC, 5 years after Rome was founded, okay? Dionysius had a tradition that the Roman Emperor Augustus reigned 43 years and then was followed by the Emperor Tiberius. Luke, I'm quoting mostly from Catholic sources tonight. Luke chapter 3, verse 1, verse 23 indicates that Jesus turned 30 years old in the 15th year of Tiberius' reign. Remember, first came Augustus, 43 years. Then it was Tiberius. Jesus turned 30 in the 15th year of Tiberius' reign. If Jesus was 30 in Tiberius' reign, that means he lived 15 years under Augustus, which would make Jesus born in the 28th year of Augustus' reign. Augustus took power in 727 AUC, which would mean, and logically Dionysius would put Jesus' birth in 754 AUC. There's only one problem with this. If Jesus was born in 754 AUC, then Luke chapter 1, verse 5 places Jesus' birth in the days of Herod. The problem is that Herod died in 750 AUC, 4 years before supposedly he was even born. So there's a stira in the actual psukim themselves as to when Jesus was born. The Catholic Church is well aware of this. Joseph A. Fitzmyer, professor emeritus of biblical studies at the Catholic University of America, and the member of the Pontifical Biblical Commission, former president of the Catholic Biblical Association, writes in the official commentary on the New Testament. This is the Church of the Catholic Church's official commentary. And this is what he writes about the date of Jesus' birth. Though the year of Jesus' birth is not reckoned with certainty, the birth did not occur in AD 1. The Christian era, supposed to have its starting point in the year of Jesus' birth, is based on a miscalculation introduced circa 533 by Dionysius Exiguus. The Catholic Church themselves says, we don't know when Jesus was born. We definitely know that he was not born in the year 754 AUC. There is this anonymous document called the De Pascha Computus that was believed to have been written around 243 CE in North Africa that says that Jesus was born in March 28th. There's a bishop whose name was Clement, who was from Alexandria. He thinks Jesus was born on November 18th. Based on historical records, Fitzmyer himself thinks that Jesus was born on September 11th. I don't know, I guess. Interesting date. And the truth is that all we really know about the birth of Jesus is that it happened in the fall. Has to do a lot with when the shepherds were out. Has to do a lot with Psukim. Not for now. But suffice it to say, it was not December 25th. Okay, consider the following quote from the Catholic Encyclopedia, 1911 edition, under Christmas. Christmas was not among the earlier festivals of the church. The first evidence of the feast is from Egypt. Okay, so it's got nothing to do with Christianity. There's an early Catholic writer whose name was Origen, who says as follows, in the scriptures, no one is recorded to have kept a feast or held a great banquet on his birthday. It is only sinners like Paro and Herod who make great rejoicings over the day on which they were born into this world. And in fact, the Encyclopedia Americana themselves say Christmas was not observed in the first centuries of the Christian church, since the Christian usage in general was to celebrate the death of remarkable persons rather than their birth. Okay, so the concept of Christmas being the birthday of Jesus, it fails on a number of levels. First of all, there's no way he was born on December 25th. There's nobody from the Catholic Church that thinks that he was born on December 25th. And also, the concept of celebrating a birthday is far into Christianity itself. So that myth needs to be put to bed. No Christian is celebrating the birth date of Jesus on December 25th. That's false. If that's what you grew up thinking, yeah, and New Year's was his bris, that's also not true. I don't know where people get these things from, but it's not true. It has no basis in reality. Okay. How did Christmas come to be celebrated on December 25th? Now, that's a very important question. The date of December 25th probably originated with an ancient birthday of the sun god Mithra, who was a pagan deity whose religious influence became widespread in the Roman Empire in the first few centuries AD. So the sun god Mithra. Mithra was related to a Semitic sun god whose name was Shamash, and his worship spread throughout Asia to Europe, where he was also called Das Sol Invictus Mirthus. Okay. More specifically, Mirtha was particularly in charge of the point where light and darkness met. Remember that in the days of December 25th, we're in the darkest days of the winter, the winter solstice, we're in the darkest days of the winter, and it was important to worship Mirtha in order to say, Mithra, rather, in order to say, we need these days to become longer, we want there to be more light. So Mithra is the god that's in charge of the balance between day and night. That was his job. Rome, one of the things that Rome was very well known for is because they were spreading throughout the entire world, what they would do is they would take all of these pagan practices and they would incorporate them into Roman culture. So when Rome took in this concept of Mithra's birthday, so there are a lot of sun gods, and one of the ways that they called their sun god was called Saturn. And so they took Mithra, and they turned it into Saturn, and they basically there was a celebration every year in Rome on December 25th to celebrate the god Saturn. Okay, Saturnalia was this holiday that was celebrated up until December 25th, and it was celebrated because of this fire god, Saturn. Saturn itself, by the way, the reason why Saturn got its name is because the planet with the rings around it is the planet that most represents the concept of fire, the concept of sun. That's where Saturn got its name from. Why is Saturn an important name here for a god, particularly in this time? Two reasons. Number one, whenever you're worshiping a sun god, what you really want from the sun god is planting. Specifically back then, when that was the main industry, you really want there to have a god that's going to help you with planting. So the first reason is that we're worshiping, not we, but the first reason that the Romans are worshiping Mithra is because they want to say, okay, we're going to need you to come. Now it's the winter, but we're going to need you to come so that we can do a good job planting. The reason he was worshipped in the dead of winter is because we want it to come as a preparation for the spring. Okay? every civilization, basically throughout time, has had some sun god. They all go by different names, okay? The Egyptians and the Romans sometimes called him the god Vulcan, for those of you who know anything about Star Trek. The Greeks named him Kronos, as did the Phoenicians, but the Phoenicians also called him Saturn. The Babylonians called him Tammuz. Okay, Tammuz was the reincarnation of Nimrod. He was the Gilgal of Nimrod, resurrected as Nimrod's son, also known as Molech, also known as Baal. Keep those names in mind, they're very important. Okay, the Druids also called him by some of these names. These are basically all just variations of the name Nimrod. Nimrod, some of you might remember, story with Avram Avinu, thrown into what? Furnace of fire. There you go. Nimrod is basically considered the father of all Babylonian gods. Fire gods have one thing in common. This is very important to note. They love child sacrifice. Very into child sacrifice. Okay? So Nimrod, Saturn, Cronus, Moloch, and Baal all basically have this one common theme, which is that they love child sacrifice. I'm quoting to you now from a book called Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. And listen to what he writes. Now, this is in exact accordance with the character of the great head of the system of fire worship. Nimrod, as the representative of the devouring fire to which human victims and especially children were offered in sacrifice, was regarded as the great child devourer. He was, of course, the actual father of all Babylonian gods, and therefore in that character, he was afterward universally regarded as the father of gods. He was, as we've seen, called Kronos, and everyone knows that the classical story of Kronos was just this. He devoured his sons as soon as they were born. Okay. And we go on, infants, apparently they loved infants, so what child sacrifice was good? If you're 8, 9 years old, okay, that's great, but little kids, even better, newborn babies, that's the best. But why was human sacrifice such a key to the worship of this terrible god? What possible good could human beings think they saw in slaughtering their own children? Listen to what he writes. He who approached the fire would receive a light of divinity, and through the divine fire, all the stains produced by generations could be purged away. Therefore, the children were made to pass through the fire unto Molech. So the reason why, this is very important, the reason why they required child sacrifice is because they were trying to rectify the sin of Adam Arishon. And only through sacrificing a child could you receive the divine light that would allow you to rectify the original sin. So when we talk about this concept of Saturnalia, of these people that were worshiping the gods of fire, understand, they were taking their newborn children, tying them up, and throwing them into the fire. And that's not, it didn't happen once, it didn't happen twice. This was a large practice of the time. When the Torah talks about anti-pagan, you know, philosophies, thou shalt not worship an Asherah tree and all that, understand, please take this very seriously. They were talking about the murder of children. They were talking about unnecessary sacrifices of animals. You're talking about basically a society that is absolutely lawless. Paganism is worse than Nazism. Nazism had a shita. We're trying to wipe out all Jews. Paganism was a concept that allowed for basically the debasement of society as a shita. Okay, so we're not talking about 6 million people. We're talking about much, much more than that. More than 6 million Jews were killed in Egypt. Okay, Mitzrayim was famous for all of their gods. The concept of paganism is much, much worse than Nazism. You guys have all heard of the phrase cannibal. Cannibal, what is a cannibal? Somebody who eats other people. That comes from this. Baal, Molech, Nimrod, all this one concept. They had Kohanim. They were their priests. Kohen Baal. What did it mean to be a Kohen Baal? If you were the Kohen of Baal, if you were a priest who served Baal, that meant that you ate from the sacrifice. Like a regular Kohen would eat in the Beis HaMikdash from the sacrifice that he offered up. If you're a Kohen Baal, you eat from the human sacrifice that you have just fought, and that is the origin of the word cannibal, which is pretty sick. Santa himself, according to Langer's Encyclopedia of World History, Santa, again, we're going to discuss Santa at length, but Santa, potentially, one of the meanings of the word Santa is that it was actually the same name as Nimrod. So it could very well be that the original Santa Claus was Nimrod. Nimrod, the same guy who needs to wipe out Avram Avinu from the face of the earth, that same guy? Yeah, big jolly fat guy now wearing a red suit and a long white beard. Could be. Not saying for sure. Just saying, something to think about. Romans had this holiday called Saturnalia. Okay? Now let's talk about what this holiday was about. During this period, Roman courts were closed. It was a 7-day period. Why were the Roman courts closed? Because everything was allowed. It was like Mardi Gras, but on steroids, and on like the best steroids. This is the steroids that like A-Rod wished he could take. Okay, this was, the festival began, listen, when Roman authorities chose an enemy of the people, an enemy of the Roman people. And what would they do with him? This enemy of the Roman people, he was titled the Lord of Misrule. Every single community selected their own enemy of the people. Okay? Throughout the week, up until December 25th, they force-fed this person and gave him as many physical pleasures as possible. Then on December 25th, believing that they were destroying the forces of darkness, they would kill this enemy of the people. The ancient Greek writer, poet, and historian Lucian describes the festival's observance as follows. In addition to human sacrifice, widespread intoxication, going from house to house while singing naked, rape and other sexual license, consuming human-shaped biscuits, which some of you might enjoy, yeah? Even children were allowed to participate in the drunken orgies of the time. Even little children were encouraged to participate in these things. Okay? What does the Catholic Church have to do with this? What does Christianity have to do with this? Well, see, Christianity had this one major problem. Nobody knew about it. There was no Christianity. There was a guy, Jesus, there were a bunch of disciples, and then that was it. So Christianity, and you're going to see this thematically, Christianity had this concept of, well, let's take in as many people as possible. Let's do whatever we have to do in order to get people to join our religion. So in the 4th century, Christianity imported the Saturnalia festival as a way of telling the pagans, hey, come with us. Yeah, all your pagan stuff, we've got it too. Just bring it in. Jesus is the Savior. No worries. Bring all your paganism with us, and this is how Christianity grew its ranks. In the 7th century, Gregory I ordered Augustine of Canterbury to include all pagan practices into the Roman Catholic Church. The problem is there's nothing intrinsically Christian about any of these pagan practices. So they came up with a great idea. Let's take December 25th, let's tell everyone that that's Jesus' birthday, and then we'll say, oh, you have this great pagan practice? Bring it in. We do everything on December 25th. So Saturnalia, which culminates on December 25th, sure, we've got that. That's Jesus' birthday. And you're going to see throughout this entire shiur, you're going to see that that was basically what they did. They took every pagan, depraved practice that was geared towards the debasement and lawlessness of the world, and they said, sure, come on in. All in the name of Kiruv. We just got to get as many people in as possible. That wasn't a comment on anybody's Kiruv practices today. As many of the writers, when you do this research, many of the writers all have the same line. I think it's a cute line. The irony here is that the birthday of the sun god now became the birthday of the Son of God. Okay, so you have this pagan practice that turns basically into another Avodah Zarah practice. Okay. The problem is that Christians were not able, they wanted to, but they were not able to refine the practices of Saturnalia. Stephen Nissenbaum, professor at UMass, writes as follows. In return for ensuring massive observance of the anniversary of the Savior's birth by assigning it to this resonant date, the church, for its part, tacitly agreed to allow the holiday to be celebrated more or less the way it had always been. Singing naked in the streets, sexual indulgence, the precursor to modern caroling, etc. In 1652, Charles I was executed, and there was a Puritan movement brought about in England. Obviously, the famous Oliver Cromwell was one of the big Puritan leaders. He basically outlawed Christmas in England because he said this is a pagan practice. And the Puritans believed that Christianity needed to be pure from pagan practices. That's Puritan, needed to be pure, separated, right? Kedusha means to separate. It needed to be pure from pagan practices, and so actually it was outlawed. The problem is that, and it was only outlawed for a couple years, it was outlawed from 1652 to 1656. The problem is that in those 4 years, all the Christian masses really wanted that Saturnalia festival. They loved it. It was a week where they could do whatever they wanted. So in 1656, the public demanded the legalization of Christmas, and they restored the monarchy under Charles II. And what Charles II did is he said, okay, in his first act, I've got the monarchy back. Time to make Christmas legal, and that's how Christmas became legal in England. Of course, the Puritans were very, very bothered, and they had lost the battle for England. but they held out hope for America. Okay, the Puritans were very instrumental in coming to America, leading everyone to America. And they the reason they held out hope is because they knew that the Catholic Church in England was very, very corrupt. And they hoped that by having this separation of church and state in America, there was going to be religious freedom. There wasn't going to be any of the bribery that existed in the Church of England. So what they did is they said, okay, hopefully in America it's going to work. The Reverend Increase Mather of Boston observed in 1687, listen what he writes, "The early Christians who first observed the Nativity on December 25th did not do so thinking that Christ was born in that month, but because the heathen Saturnalia was at that time kept in Rome, and they were willing to have those pagan holidays metamorphed into Christian ones. Further, can you in conscience think that your holy Savior is honored by hard drinking, lewd reveling, and a mass for none but Bacchus or Saturn?" Again, this is what the Puritans themselves, they understood that this whole concept was distorted. They understood that Christianity basically was selling its soul for the simple concept of let's bring more people in. And because of its known pagan origins, the Puritans banned Christmas, and its observance was illegal in Massachusetts from 1659 through 1681. Actually, it was only in the mid-19th century that Christmas actually became a legal holiday throughout all of America. The reason it became legal is twofold. Number one, following the Christian tradition, the American Sunday School Society was realizing that there was nobody coming to fill the pews in the churches. So they said, we need to have a way of filling the pews. Let's take this day, December 25th, let's teach everyone about the Nativity, let's create that whole manger scene that you see on the front lawns of many churches. Right, and in an effort to grow attendance, we're going to tell all the little children, if you come, you get candy. The reason why this is important is because that has the same theme as Halloween. That's how they got people into the pagan practices of Halloween. It's the same theme. If you come, we get candy. Okay. In 1843, this was the other major movement. Charles Dickens wrote a book. Some of you may have heard of this book. It's called A Christmas Carol. And in 1867, he did a speaking tour across America to packed audiences depicting this beautiful Christmas scene. And all Americans said, we want this. And that's when it became legal throughout the United States. Okay. How much, I'm quoting now from the Neustadt Herzog Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge, how much the date of the festival depended on the pagan Brumalia, December 25th following the Saturnalia, December 17th through the 24th, and celebrating the shortest day of the year and the new sun cannot be accurately determined. The pagan Saturnalia and Brumalia were too deeply entrenched in popular custom to be set aside by Christian influence. The pagan festival with its riot and merrymaking was so popular that Christians were glad for the excuse to continue its celebration with little change in spirit and in manner. Christian preachers of the West and Near East protested against this unseemly frivolity with which Christ's birthday was celebrated. While Christians of Mesopotamia accused their Western brethren of idolatry and sun worship for adopting as Christians this pagan festival. Even the Christians themselves, again, I'm not even talking about the Puritans now, but even the early Western Christians understood that this was a total distortion of the concept of celebrating Jesus with paganism. Jesus was in no way in favor of paganism. In fact, it's one of the major problems that the Muslims and, of course, the Jews had with Christianity at its early roots, that it was basically based in paganism. In 1990, in an Ohio Cleveland suburb, a school board banned all nativity and other Christmas scenes on any school property because they felt that it violated the separation of church and state. Parents were outraged. You are taking away Christmas. It went to court. The school board lost. The school board lost. Why did the school board lose? Because the court determined Christmas has no Christian roots. It's not a Christian holiday. It's a pagan holiday. So there's no separation of church and state here because it has nothing to do with church. So if you want to go and you want to celebrate all these Christmas things, by all means, go ahead. It's not a religious practice. This is what the court in America ruled. However, prayer and Bible reading, they determined, cannot be done from this Christmas stuff because that is uniquely church-oriented. So they were willing to outlaw prayer and Bible reading. This is the courts in Cleveland. Were willing to outlaw prayer and Bible reading, but they allowed for the pagan minhagim of Saturnalia. Okay, so what were some of the depraved customs of Saturnalia? Now, this is where it gets really uncomfortable for Jews. In 1466, Pope Paul II, for the amusement of the Roman citizens, forced Jews to race naked through the city streets. An eyewitness account reports, and I'm quoting now, "Before they were to run, the Jews were richly fed so as to make the race more difficult for them, and at the same time more amusing for the spectators. They ran amid Rome's taunting shrieks and peals of laughter, while the Holy Father stood upon a richly ornamented balcony and laughed heartily. At the Saturnalia Carnival in the 18th and 19th century, rabbis of the ghetto in Rome were forced to wear clownish outfits and march through the city streets to the jeers of the crowds, pelted by a variety of missiles. The Jewish community of Rome sent a petition in 1836 to Pope Gregory, begging him to stop the abuse. What was his response? And I quote, 'It is not an opportune time to make any innovations.' On December 25th, 1881, Christian leaders whipped the Polish masses into a frenzy, led riots across the country. In Warsaw, 12 Jews were brutally murdered. Huge numbers were maimed. Many Jewish women were raped. 2 million rubles worth of property were destroyed. This is the holiday of Saturnalia that has always been, historically, it has always been a time where they raced Jews through the streets. It's always been a time where they murdered our people. It's always been a time where they said, 'This Judaism is nonsense, let's ridicule it for the masses.' That is the origin of Christmas. That is the pagan practice in which they first pulled Christianity, first pulled the Saturnalia holiday in and said, 'Let's get Christmas started, everybody come worship Jesus.' The origins of Christmas customs, and there are quite a few, let's try to get through them. We don't have a tremendous amount of time. Let's try to get through a couple of them. We'll deal with, hopefully, Christmas trees, mistletoe, Christmas presents, the Yule log, the wreath, and most importantly, Santa Claus. Okay. Number one, origins of the Christmas tree. So number one, we have the Asherah cult, which some of you have learned about in the Gemara. The Gemara talks about you're not allowed to worship an Asherah tree, right? So that was a Christmas tree. Quoting here, an old Babylonish fable of an evergreen tree which sprang out of a dead tree stump. The old stump represented the dead Nimrod. The new evergreen tree, remember I told you that Nimrod was reincarnated? So the new evergreen tree that grew out of this old stump, that represented Nimrod coming to life again in Tammuz. Okay, that's from Curiosities of Popular Customs. Listen to the following quote from the Dictionary of Greek and Roman Antiquities. All ranks devoted themselves to feasting and mirth. Presents were exchanged among friends. Crowds thronged the streets, shouting, "Lo Saturnalia!" An offering was made beneath a decorated evergreen tree, according to the pagan poet Virgil. Figurines and masks, called oscilla, were hung on the tree as our Christmas decorations today. History admits there can be no doubt that we have in these oscilla a relic of human sacrifice. They used to hang these little faces, these human sacrificial faces. Those were the original Christmas decorations. So people today lighting up their Christmas tree, that's human sacrifice right there. Bringing evergreen trees into the home, that was actually a German tradition. It came to England from King George I, who himself was of Germanic lineage, and came to America when the Germans made Aliyah, so to speak, into Pennsylvania. In 1848, how did it really grow in England? In 1848, there was a newspaper called the London Illustrated News, and they published an engraving of Queen Victoria and her family next to a decorated tree. Within a few years, out of tribute to the royal court, everybody in England was bringing these evergreen trees into their house and was decorating these evergreen trees. Okay, so evergreen trees are either the reincarnation of the god Nimrod, god of fire, human sacrifice, oscilla, that's the original decorations of the tree, human sacrifice, and at the very least, it's part of the Asherah cult, which is absolutely usher to worship. I heard a story from a certain Rav. He was an out-of-town Rav, and his kids, they were living next door to this Catholic couple, and they were bringing this Christmas tree into the house, and the kids started asking their father, like, do the Christians have halachos when it comes to the Christmas tree? Like, does it have to be like 10 tefachim high? Does it dafka need to be near a window? Is there like an Indian of Pirsim Hanes? You know? No, of course not. It's a pagan custom. It's absolutely a pagan custom. Mistletoe. This is a good one. Some of you guys will recognize some of these names from some of the movies about Thor coming out. Norse mythology recounts how the god Baldur was killed using a mistletoe arrow by his rival god Hodur while fighting for the female Nanna. Druid rituals use mistletoe to poison their human sacrificial victims. The Christian custom of kissing under the mistletoe is a later synthesis of the sexual license of Saturnalia combined with the druidic sacrificial cult. Additionally, druids believed that a woman, when she was under the influence of this mistletoe, was helpless to any sexual exploitation. And therefore, that began the minhag of, if you're under the mistletoe, you have to give me a kiss. Christmas presents. In pre-Christian Rome, the emperors compelled their most despised citizens to bring offering and gifts during Saturnalia and Calends. Calends is in January. Later, this ritual expanded to give gifts to the general public in this time, and the church gave it a Christian flavor by rerouting it in the supposed gift-giving of St. Nicholas, who we'll speak about when it comes the time. The Yule log. You guys are familiar with this concept of a Yule log? What do they do with the Yule log? They burn the Yule log. They have a whole thing. They burn the Yule log. What is a Yule log? So the Yule log is Teutonic nature worship. Like mistletoe, holly berries were also thought to be from this sun god. The original sun log became the Yule log. Yule simply means wheel. Wheels, by the way, very important. You'll see because in pagan literature, when you have a wheel of something, that accentuates its power. Whenever you have a circle of something, that gives it even more power. By the way, that's a concept, again, not that we have that concept in Yiddishkeit, because that's idolatry, but that's the concept of a circle is a very powerful concept, even in Yiddishkeit. Today, when we talk about the Yule, meaning a wheel, it's a representation of the sun. The wheel here represents the sun, and people today call it the sacred Yuletide season. It's because that was sun worship geared towards human sacrifice. Yule actually is spelled J-U-L, is also the pagan god of sex and fertility, and the Yule log itself is a giant phallic symbol, according to some researchers. The log itself was kept burning for 12 days. That introduces the concept of the 12 days of Christmas on the first day of Christmas, right? That's where that comes from, because you always think Christmas only one day, right? On the first day of Christmas, how'd they get 12 days of Christmas? It came because this Yule concept, the log was kept burning for 12 days. What did they do with the 12 days that this log was burning? Well, you know, the regular human sacrifice, child sacrifice, animal sacrifice, and this was done in an effort to make contact with the pagan gods. The problem is that, again, the church had a real issue. How do we have this 12-day festival, you know, talking about this Yule thing with January 6th? How does December 25th become January 6th? How do we put these two things together? So they had a great idea. They said, oh yeah, January 6th, that's the day of Epiphany. What's the day of Epiphany? Well, these three wise men, they came bearing gifts, frankincense, myrrh, and gold. They came on that day, the day of Epiphany, right? So that, you know when that was? That was January 6th. The only problem is there's absolutely no scriptural references in any of the apostles to indicate that there was actually a day for it. And the reason is because it's absolutely made up. And they made it up because they had a major problem. This date has nothing to do with anything, but we need to get those pagan Yule worshippers into Christianity. Here's a really important one. During this Yuletide season, the sacred Yuletide season, how did you know if somebody was worshiping Yule? Well, he would keep a lit lamp in his window. And he would have his house would have lights on it so that everyone would know that he's a worshiper of Yule. And that's how we today have the whole concept of the Christmas lights. That's also from this pagan practice called Yule. And when somebody wishes you Yuletide greetings, they're actually wishing you greetings for the pagan god of fertility. Okay, where does a wreath come from? By the way, this is all just warm up for when we get to Santa Claus. When we get to Santa Claus, it's all over. The Christmas wreath, many believe, Frederick Haskin writes, that it's traceable to the pagan custom of decorating buildings and places of worship at the feast, which took place at the same time as Christmas. Holly and other greens were put up in order to ward off evil. So when you sing the song, deck the halls with boughs of holly, that's actually an acknowledgement to the nature gods. And, you know, the circle, as we mentioned, that's a way of accentuating power. Encyclopedia Britannica brings it down like this. European pagans brought holly sprays into their home, offering them to the fairy people of the forests as refuges from the harsh winter weather. Okay, I don't know. Some of you are into that Once Upon a Time show. So maybe you could... Maybe Itai, we could give this to Tinkerbell, and she could ward off Peter Pan. It's pathetic that I even know that. Okay, Santa Claus. This is like my favorite one of all. Okay, so first of all, the concept of a hearth god. I know, it's okay, I'll survive. Or not, but whatever, that's fine. The concept of a hearth god is not, that's not uniquely Santa Claus. There have been many hearth gods throughout the generations. And basically, they're there to guard the chimneys and make sure that the people are warm. You know, because if you're living in the olden times and you know, it's like Mivasara when there's no electricity and heat. So you really want your gods to be guarding the chimneys. In some sects, these hearthen gods would come down the chimneys and give you presents if you were good and be upset at you and give you a whip or a snitch if you were bad, okay? So that's the basic concept of where this comes from, but actually there's something much, much bigger there. Okay, who was Nicholas? So first of all, Nicholas was not, he didn't have a red suit and he wasn't white. He was actually Middle Eastern. Nicholas was born in Perara, Turkey in 270 CE. And he became the bishop of Myra. He died in 345 CE on December 6th. He wasn't made a saint until the 19th century. For most of his life, he was not a saint. Okay, what's really important about Nicholas to know is he was probably responsible for the deaths of more Jews than anybody else in history. He convened this thing called the Council of Nicaea. And in the Council of Nicaea in 325 CE, that's when they created the New Testament. And that was the text that portrayed Jews as the children of the devil, who sentenced Jesus to death. And that line right there, I just want you to underscore that for a minute, because that line is really important. For example, when the Catholic Church did not get involved in the Holocaust, you understand it's because Be'etzem, they believe that we're responsible for the death of Jesus, and we are the children of the devil. That was St. Nick. That was St. Nick right there. So the choice to say, yeah, these people are responsible for basically the breakdown of the world, yeah, and again, the millions and millions and millions of deaths, the Crusades, and again, it's so much more than that, all really comes from this guy, St. Nicholas. When he died, so he was buried in Turkey, but in 1087, there was a group of sailors who moved his bones from Turkey to a sanctuary in Bari, Italy. One of the things that they thought Nicholas did is he was like the god of this, he was the keeper of the seas. They thought that he actually captured the devil. So Nicholas was the guy who guarded you on the high seas. Again, not like flying today where it's safe, traveling by boat, quite dangerous. So they brought him to Bari, Italy. And in Bari, Italy, there was another god whose name was called the Grandmother, or called Pasqua Afafania. And Pasqua Afafania, she had this minug. She would fill the children's socks with gifts. So when Nicholas came to Bari, Italy, the first thing they did is they merged him with the grandmother who puts gifts into stockings. Okay. And she basically was ousted from her shrine in Bari, and that's where the Nicholas cult really took hold. And every year, on December 6th, which was the date that Nicholas died, all of the worshippers in this Nicholas cult, they would get together and give each other gifts, just like Pasqua Afafania, the grandmother, would do for her people. The Nicholas cult spread until it was basically adopted by the German and Celtic pagans. And these groups worshipped a pantheon led by Woden. Some of you might be familiar with Woden, who was the father of Thor. Very good. For those of you who have seen the movie, Woden is the father of Thor, Baldur, and Tu. Woden had a long white beard and rode a horse through the heavens one evening every single fall. When Nicholas merged with Woden, because remember, Nicholas went from Bari, Italy, just follow the path, because this is really important. He went from Turkey to Italy, now he's German, very Prussian. Yeah, so when Nicholas merged, that's right, I just did that. When Nicholas merged with Woden, sometimes you don't know what your hands are doing. Anyway, try teaching Suvis one time. So he couldn't look Mediterranean anymore because now he was German. So he went from, you know, being Arab, Israeli, Turkey, you know, and now he's, you know, kind of German, Ein Zwein, very, very proper. And so he rescheduled his flight for December and had to don heavy winter clothing because, of course, you know, quite cold in Germany. So the Catholic Church also, hey, we wanted these Nicholas guys to be a part of the Catholic Church. So they went to these Nicholas guys and they said, listen, your idea for gift giving December 6th, it's a cool idea. You should come with us. We've got a day like this. You only have to move it a couple weeks. Just move it to December 25th. And hence gift giving on Christmas was born. In 1809,
famous novelist Washington Irving, wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle, wrote a satire of Dutch culture entitled The Knickerbocker History. And that's actually where the Knicks get their name from. The satire refers several times to a white-bearded, flying horse-riding St. Nicholas, but it used his Dutch name, which was Santa Claus. St. Nicholas, the Dutch name was Santa Claus. That's from Washington Irving. Clement Moore, who was a professor at Union Seminary, he read Knickerbocker History, and he published a poem based on this book. And listen how the poem goes. Some of you might be familiar with this. "'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hope that St. Nicholas would soon be there. And Moore innovated a portraying a Santa with eight reindeer who descended through the chimney." That's one idea of where the reindeer come from. Others contend that the reindeer was actually the devil himself, who was portrayed as a goat with horns and often was portrayed with a mug and dovid on his forehead because it was symbolic of anybody that rejected Jesus. And this goat-horned devil was metamorphed into these reindeer throughout time. We're not done yet. There was a guy, Thomas Nast. Thomas Nast almost completed the modern picture of Santa Claus. From 1862 to 1886, Nast drew 2,200 cartoon images of Santa for Harper Weekly, which was a publishing at the time. Before Nast, what did Santa Claus look like? So he'd been everything from a very stern-looking bishop to a gnome-like figure in a frock. He looked Haredi, actually. And Santa at that time was a really nasty figure. He knows if you've been naughty, he knows if you've been nice, right? This is very dangerous because if you've been bad, so you get snatched up and taken away. So this was a very angry kind of Santa Claus. Nash kind of switched that from being this very Germanic, angry Santa Claus to being this sort of, very cheerful person. He gave him a home at the North Pole, a workshop full of Chinese elves, and a list of good and bad children of the world. All Santa was missing was his red outfit. And now comes the famous ending. This is where Coca-Cola did not invent Santa Claus. They didn't invent Santa Claus. Santa Claus was around way before Coca-Cola. But in 1931, they hired this Swedish commercial artist, whose name was Haddon Sundblom, to create a Coke-drinking Santa. And Sundblom had this fat friend. His name was Lou Prentice. And his really fat, chubby, cheerful face. And Sundblom could think of nobody better than Lou Prentice to make into the modern-day Santa. So that's the face that that smiling Santa face. That guy's Lou Prentice. I hate to be that guy's wife. And the only problem is that Sundblom made him with this, classic, black sort of, Haredi-looking guy. And Coca-Cola is all about red. So Coca-Cola came back to them and they said, it's a great drawing, we love it, it's a happy, cheerful Santa. We just need to do one thing. We need you to make him have a red frock. And that is where the red coat of Santa was born. So what is Santa? He's a blend of a Christian crusader, a pagan god, and a commercial idol. Just so you understand how much... I know, it's like a sort of ridiculous thing. I was talking to my father this afternoon, as some of you know, he's the president of the Syndicated Network Television Association. And I asked my dad, I said, you wouldn't happen to know how much retail sales there are throughout America, just America, during the holiday season. He said, actually, I just had to do a presentation on this, so I happen to have the figures right in front of me. He called up the figures and he said, well, it's kind of interesting. The retail sales throughout the year, minus the holiday season in America, is $602 billion yearly. Retail sales during the holiday season, $602 billion. Holiday season sales literally make up 50% of retail sales across America. So this concept of gift giving, this concept of Santa Claus in the mall, this whole pagan sort of, devil worship concept, so it's responsible today, just to understand, just America alone, for roughly $600 billion worth of sales. So what's the challenge here? Because some of you said to me, knowing that I was giving this year, some of you said to me, okay, that's what it was, but like, what's that got to do with me now? What's the big deal? I walk through, I see the lights are pretty, it's so nice, I see people, it's nice, everyone's giving tzedakah, it's great, people are giving gifts, you have all these cool, commercials that come out. I saw one by WestJet that they just gave, I don't know if you guys saw this, but they had this like sort of machine where you could say whatever you wanted and they were flying to a certain destination. And when they arrived, they got all their gifts, you know, and it, you know, T-Mobile did one thing, you know, with the welcome home for the holiday season. What's wrong? It's a beautiful. It's nice. It's nice. Okay. The problem is this, and it's a little bit of a harsh thing to say, but I think it's true. In 1933 through 1945, the Nazi regime celebrated Hitler's birthday, which took place on April 20th. So let's imagine for a second that they named the day Hitler Day. April 20th is Hitler Day. And what is Hitler Day all about? Well, you know, the classics. We're going to drink, we're going to eat, we're going to give gifts, various pagan practices, and of course, we're going to torture the Jews. Because what would a good German holiday be without killing a few Jews? You know, it used to be that people walked in the streets, that they saw a Jew. In those times, they literally would see a Jew, pull out a gun, shoot him in the head, leave the Jew dying there. That was a common practice. Jews were, you know, the insects of the German society. So, you know, no problem. Okay. Now, we won the war. The Americans won the war, the British won the war, kind of. And the, they did all the grunge work, you know. And, so we won the war, and it didn't turn out that people celebrate Hitler's birthday. Though, by the way, there are many places in America today that unfortunately still celebrate Hitler's birthday. One of the most shocking things to me was when Sacha Baron Cohen came out with that video, Throw the Jew Down the Well, and all the Jewish teenagers that I knew thought that was so funny. And I was in there going, like, you guys understand that historically, like, this is really sad. It's really sick. There are people in America, you know, just, you know, regular old rednecks in America that are singing, throw the Jew down the well. Yeah, that's a really distorted thing. And actually, I kind of saw it and I said, like, wow, that's really disturbing. And somehow this was like this amazing comedy video that all of you guys thought was great. I wonder how your grandparents would feel about that. But anyway, so now you have this day, Hitler Day. Hitler Day. You know, regular day. Now, we won the war. So now imagine 100 years from now, let's say the Germans had won the war. Let's say the Germans had won the war. And 100 years from now, you know, there's this day, Hitler Day, but nobody thinks of it as Hitler Day anymore. You know, Hitler's dead. And this, okay, and like the Jews remain, because we always do. So, okay, so what's the big deal? What's the big deal? Isn't Christmas pretty? Isn't Hitler Day pretty? What's the big deal? So I just want you to know, what do you think your grandparents in Auschwitz would have thought about their great-great-grandchildren celebrating Hitler Day? No, Grandma, you don't understand. I know your entire family was wiped out, but I'm not doing it for that reason. It's not really connected. I'm not doing it for that reason. You can't get away from that. That's the origins of something. The roots of the tree define what the tree is. And that is the challenge of Hitler Day. And I want to read to you from the words of Julius Streicher, Yimach Shemam, who was one of Hitler's most vicious assistants. And he wrote an editorial in an anti-Semitic newspaper called Der Strömer in 1941, December 25th, on Christmas. Listen what he writes. If one really wants to put an end to the continued prospering of this curse from heaven that is the Jewish blood, there is only one way to do it, to eradicate this people, the Satan's son, root and branch. That was his Christmas thought. See, the Nazis knew it. The Nazis understood. You want to understand, you want to get to the root of it? You want to get to the root of it? Wipe out Satan's son. So this holiday, let's chazer over and we'll finish with this. This holiday, yeah, that's celebrated from its earliest times as a pagan sun god, yeah, designed for human sacrifice, designed for the murder of children, designed to create a lawless society, right, was incorporated into Christianity, the same Christianity that brought in all sorts of paganism from what we learned about the mistletoe to the gift-giving to Saint Nicholas, who again, personally responsible for the death of millions of Jews. This is Christianity today. This is Christmas. Ah, you look at all the TV shows and you look at it and it's so beautiful and everyone's getting together. Great. That's great. That's great for everyone to get together. Very nice. But it has nothing to do with Christmas. It has nothing to do with the origins of Christmas. And you can't separate it. And that's the bottom line. Now, what's the reason for me giving you this shiur tonight? What's the reason for me giving you this sicha? I have no doubt that none of you have any intention of worshiping, you know, Christmas, being involved in Christmas. I know that I'm not worried that any of you guys are going to have a Hanukkah bush in your house. That's not what I'm telling you. But I am telling you something much more subtle. You guys, particularly as Americans, are subject to a culture that is very much antithetical to the way that we live here in Israel, which is much more pristine. And because we are surrounded on all of our sides by our Arab cousins who don't like us so much, it makes it much easier to remember that a Jew is a Jew. And what you may not realize is happening all around America is the self-inflicted Holocaust of assimilation. And I want you to know that while none of you guys will assimilate, I'm confident that none of you will assimilate. What I do wonder, to be perfectly honest with you, is how much the Catholic culture, how much the Christian culture has infiltrated your Judaism. And that's an important question to ask. Because when we identify so strongly with a holiday season that is geared towards the destruction of our people, one has to stop and wonder, what really is the value of being a part of this? And that's a question that I can't answer for you, but it is a question that you have to ask for yourself. How much do I want my Judaism to be pure and pristine? And I'll leave you with the following thought. When my father made Aliyah, so I was still living in America. My parents had decided to make Aliyah. And I asked my father, what is it like to live here in Israel? And my father said to me, it's like playing for the home team. And I'll leave you with that because, yes, we in this country, we can grate on each other's nerves and we can be frustrating to deal with and we scream at people unnecessarily and we're not really angry, it's just the way that we talk. But I have to wonder the trade-off of, is it worth it, you know, for the Midos Tovos of America, I have to wonder if it's worth the cultural assimilation that's occurring all over the place.